I am Platt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more compelling books of the year is The Couch of Willingness, An Alcoholic Therapist Battles the Bottle and a Broken Recovery System. It's an often harrowing book, but it's also honest, sometimes humorous, and always informative. Michael Pond had spent 20 years helping clients deal with their addictions as a successful therapist. He loses his practice, his family, his home, and ends up in need of help from our system, one he soon realizes that needs work. In this book, Mike Pond and Maureen Palmer write about Mike's struggle, his recovery, and some prescriptions to our broken system. I'll ask Mike and Maureen, who join me now, about what they view as possible cures to a system that could help a lot more people. I'll get Mike to tell us his story, and I'll get Maureen to tell us about how she came into his life and how they've now brought us this book that's hard to put down. Mike Pond pursued psychiatric nursing before receiving a degree in social work from UBC in 1995. He worked in the public sector before he began a successful practice in Penticton. Maureen Palmer is a principal at Bountiful Films with Helen Slinger, and the company has produced many critically acclaimed and popular documentaries. She was a senior producer at the CBC until leaving it in 2000 to produce programming for TLC and Discovery. She and Mike live in North Vancouver, where they join me from this morning. This book is published by Everywhere Now. Go to michaelpond.ca for more information. Please welcome to the Platt on the Line program Mike Pond and Maureen Palmer. Ms. Palmer, good morning.
Good morning.
And Mr. Pond, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
This is, as I said to you before we started, such a difficult book to put down. It's such a compelling one. Did you know just how much this book could strike a chord, Mike?
Well, when Maureen and I decided that we were going to, you know, write a book 3 years ago, I had no idea it was going to have the response that it seems to be having already, and it's not even released officially till tomorrow, so... Yeah, it's quite exciting for me, absolutely.
And I understand, Maureen, it was excerpted in the Vancouver Sun recently, and you guys must have gotten a lot of great feedback from readers.
A lot of great feedback from the Vancouver Sun, and also we were excerpted in the Tyee, which is a really fabulous online BC-based paper.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to add, you know, when I first met Mike, and he told me his story over a succession of two or three dates, my mind went into storytelling mode, and I went, oh, a femme fatale, a car chase, a hero who overcomes amazing obstacles, and I can't believe it, even a prison standoff. We obviously have to write a book. I don't know if I want to date you, but I want to write a book with you.
So that's how you guys met, right? You met online. And
Plenty of fish.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was her 50th date.
Really?
She was busy.
Well, the young people where Mike worked at Surrey Memorial, they saw how lonely he was, and they really didn't know any of his backstory then, and they put him on Plenty of Fish. And when I read his profile, I was intrigued. And then when he was so bald-faced, straight up, recounting exactly what happened, I had a lot of admiration and respect for the obvious integrity that was there.
Your friends told you that you ought to run away, but you didn't. Why not?
Well, you know, I'd been dating a few men who they were just not fond of, and first thing they said was, Maureen, you're 50 now. It's time you actually find a man with money. So unbeknownst to them, Michael had, like, less than any money. I just saw a real spark of passion for life and for doing things right, and somebody who had just this unbelievable resilience and almost a defiance about taking on a system that didn't work for him. And I wanted to help him with that.
Mike, you were a successful therapist for 20 years, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I was successful. I had a great practice in Penticton. We moved up there about 20 years ago when my boys were just little guys, and I broke service from the government and started this little practice in Penticton, and over, you know, the course of about 12-13 years, it flourished and became something quite successful. We had a wonderful life there, a beautiful home on the lake, and it was a grand life, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you have any idea, though, Mike, that the system was broken as it was, or as it is, I should say?
No, I didn't. You know, I I did addiction counseling, but it was more the assessment, refer on. I would refer people to the usual treatment centers or the local addictions community-based resource that we'd have. I had no idea, really. And then when my drinking progressed and it got terribly bad, I, you know, was sent to AA, or it was, it's the recommended thing to do by everybody, the doctors and anybody else you talk to. Oh, you got to go AA, you got to go AA. And it was really tough for me, you know, to be in the community where I was higher profile to do that. And it didn't really ring for me. And
well, I think what, you know, Mike didn't know then, and we've only recently come to understand, you know, based upon the work of Lance Doty's at Harvard, mm-hmm. you know, only 1 in 10 people actually succeed in AA. And there's no follow-up for the 9 out of 10 that don't, because AA has very little scientific, I don't even know if it has any scientific basis. And I think what Michael learned, number one, out of his whole struggle is that AA is support, and it helps a lot of people, but it is not treatment. And treatment needs to be evidence, medical, and science-based. And we don't ask anybody else who's suffering from some kind of life-threatening disorder or illness to go to a support group.
Yeah.
Right. And as I tumbled down, you know, the socioeconomic strata and was homeless and penniless on the streets and ended up in one of these down-and-out recovery houses, and in Vancouver alone we have 200 unlicensed, unregulated recovery houses, I just couldn't believe what was happening. And the kind of confrontational, punitive approach and the shaming, and my goodness, I know now for sure that the main thing we're going to do is change the conversation about this thing.
And never mind those things, Michael. I mean, the threats to life and safety when you mm-hmm. have a rat falling on your head while you're shaving.
Yeah.
When you wake up in the middle of the night and somebody's holding a knife to your throat.
Yeah.
You know, when somebody, when you're actively suicidal, suggests they'll drive you to the Portman Bridge, that's not treatment. And I wouldn't even call that support. And to use the word recovery in the title of those places is like an anathema to me.
Yeah.
What, the one recovery house I was in, within five weeks, two young men hanged themselves, and it was, I had to cut one guy down that was in the backyard, an old child swing, and he was gone, and we tried to resuscitate him, and just the whole lack of supervision and monitoring and safety, just the basics. Yeah. And the other recovery house I was in, the director disappeared for 2 weeks. We found out he was down in Vegas on our welfare checks. And we were left in this recovery house eating nothing but donated bread and a pail, half a pail, 5-gallon pail of rancid peanut butter. It was unbelievable.
Yeah. And so why don't you think we know more about this stuff? I mean, like, why aren't there exposés on TV mm-hmm. and the newspapers?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there has been some limited writing about the recovery homes.
Yeah.
I think in a lot of way what happens in recovery homes is a reflection of our greater attitude towards addiction. I do think there's, you know, lots of kind-hearted people out there, but there's a general idea in society still that addicts deserve what they get. Excuse me, I got a cough for a second.
In my practice now, I don't even use the word addict or alcoholic anymore. And uh-huh. In fact, the DSM-5, you know, it's termed substance use disorder or substance use problem. It's on a spectrum, because whenever you use those words, I mean, right away everybody goes, oh, you know, another addict, oh, another alcoholic, and it it's what I had to deal with, and personally,
yeah.
Especially when I was down that low.
Yeah.
Actually, we had a book launch last night, a private one, and several people there said they will never look at a panhandler again the same. Some of them say, I look at them now and I see Michael.
Yeah.
And so if anything, it sort of humanizes the people that are especially prevalent in Vancouver.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, we just assume that if we see someone down and out on the street, that you know, it's their fault that, you know, they're lazy or, you know, just can't get a job, right? Or don't want to get a job.
Yeah, and I was, you know, one of those guys down there and experienced that and felt that. And I'll tell you, when you personally experience it, you realize what that, you know, I said last night that the last job I had ever want to do is be a panhandler.
Yeah.
because you were so bad at it.
I was terrible at it. I was poorly educated at panhandling. I needed a mentor to teach me, to show me how to panhandle properly.
Yeah, no, you see people, like, I mean, I go downtown at night sometimes, you know, coming home from something, and some of the better panhandlers are really savvy, and they know stuff, so they obviously have, you know, some knowledge and some smarts that go beyond whatever their circumstances.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, Maureen, did you find finding out about, not just finding out about Mike's story and the sort, but finding out about where we are in society, the stigma, the system, how broken that is? I mean, that must have shocked you. I mean, it shocks me listening to you guys now and having read the book. It's appalling, really.
Yeah, you know, I've known this bunch of homeless guys that used to been in my alley behind my old place in Kitts. And I ended up over the years talking to them, and I got some indication of how desperate their addiction was, some of the things those guys would do. But I never had any comprehension of what went on in recovery houses and how really, and quite a few of those guys had been in them, the chances of actually overcoming an addiction and getting sober in there, well, that's just ridiculous. Mm. Especially if you have what Mike would call a concurrent disorder. I think, what was it, Mike, 50 or 60 people? 60%.
Well, the conservative figure is 60%, but you know what? I know it's more than that.
Have mental disorders as well as have an addiction. And in some of those recovery homes, most of them, you're not allowed to have medication, life-saving medication in some cases. So how it's this awful, you know, Sophie's choice. You can get sober, but your bipolar is going to be out of control.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Mike, it was drinking for you, right? I mean,
yeah, I'm kind of a rare breed these days, because it's usually there's polysubstance use problems. Most individuals now, they have, you know, they're addicted to the booze and the crack and crystal meth, and we're a rare breed. But you know what? That may have just been based on where I was at the time.
Yeah.
You know, because I know, because I have a practice in West Van. You know, we have people in this area that are, you know, very successful and financially, you know, well off, and I deal with the alcohol abuse, you know, quite
daily,
quite uh-huh. Regularly. That's for sure.
Yeah,
it's a huge problem.
What's the process like in having to talk about all of this again as you are now and having relive this with the book? I mean, when you go through something, when you go through all the things that you've gone through, having to talk about it again, is that part of the recovery? Is that part of the getting better?
Well, yeah, I've been asked that question specifically. That writing this book over the last 3 years, Joe, has been so therapeutic. And especially, you know, with Maureen starting a relationship and writing this book together. I mean, Maureen is remarkable. She's an unbelievable storyteller, and she is so generous of spirit. It's remarkable as well. I mean, when I'd been dating, and I'd seen a few ladies by then when I met Mo, and as soon as I told them that, you know, well, I'm an alcoholic, that was it. They would say things like, oh, I don't date men that are under 5'10". I'll see you, bye. You know, and I knew it was because, you know, yeah. As soon as I told them I was an alcoholic, that was the end of it. And I was walking up towards the Steamworks Bistro, and I see Mo, this little lady, diminutive, cute little woman out front, digging into her big fat purse that was resting on her thigh. A curler falls out onto the ground, and she's looking for change for a street fellow.
Yeah.
And I went, hey, this one may have potential. You know, and that was what compelled me to just open up with her right from the get-go. And
well, I think it speaks to the power of narrative, too. Like Michael mm-hmm. says, when he's helping his mm-hmm. clients heal, you know, writing their stories down, journaling. What he did and what we did in a much more professional context was we journaled his story. And I think it helped him give it context. It also, you know, as I wrote with him, he would write a scene, and I would say, honey, was it really that bad? Was there anything ever good about that man? So he actually, over time, got, I think, more of a realistic perspective. Yeah. Things weren't always as bad. He saw the opportunity to portray, you know, maybe a nice part of that person's personality. So over time, he moved away from being bitter and angry about his experience to becoming much more accepting and also I think, more driven because he had the knowledge to write and the knowledge as a therapist to help change it for everybody else who can't, who's locked in that system.
You know, in reading the book, Mike is really, and we're talking like he's not in the room, but he really is just a resilient guy, isn't he?
Yeah, you know, can we say the words cocky little bastard?
Because
people all his life have said that, and I think that there's an element of that. I mean, that's obviously a little bit pejorative, but there's an element of positivity in that, and it's that, you know, he just refuses to accept that he's going to stay down.
Yeah.
Well, and in one of the particular recovery houses, the so-called counselor, he was the one that came up to me, and I was in a deep depression. I was actively suicidal, and had actually gone out and made an attempt to end my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back, and the counselor director of this one house, he says, you want to effing off yourself? You can't even do that, right? Let's go. Get in my car right now, and you know, I'll stop at Canadian Tire and get the rope, you know? And when we got back, or when I went back downstairs, something shifted in me, Joe, and I just went, you know what? I am not going to let these guys do this to me.
Mm.
And I just, that moment, I just started to turn this thing around. And see, when you're so sick, mentally so unwell, and so damaged from the alcohol and everything, the sleep deprivation and the poor diet, you're in this flight-fight response, and it's all about flight, because and so everything you see it as a threat, and it creates this unbelievable state of fear and anxiety that it's almost impossible to get out of unless you come to some determination that you got to do it or die.
Yeah.
And then I had the blessing of meeting Maureen, and I just said to her one day, you know, I think it was the third date, I just said, you know what, Maureen, I just need somebody to believe in me again.
Yeah.
I just need somebody to be on my side and believe me. And away we went.
Yeah. In the course of the work that you do, Mike, the research you've done, firsthand research, do you have a sense of how the brain works and how one becomes an addict? Why can't you have a drink as opposed to, say, someone else who can have a drink at dinner every night?
Well, you know, there's the whole genetic theories. I'm still researching that one, because my grandfather was an alcoholic, severe alcoholic. He was the town drunk, and he died at 58. My dad, alcoholic. There's out of us four kids, I'm the oldest. There's three of us that would be deemed alcoholics. So there is the genetic predisposition. There is the genetic vulnerability. Whether there's an exact gene, they haven't found that yet. And then the environmental issues. But in terms of what happens to my brain, it's classic when you look at all the research and literature that for whatever reasons we have lower dopamine levels, which is the neurotransmitter that's about reward and pleasure. Ours is lower. And then you take some booze, you take some drugs, or whatever else, the dopamine starts to surge, and the brain loves it, and it wants more. And this is the vicious cycle we get into. And I believe that through writing this book and the other things that I've done, I created some new neural pathways in my brain.
Mm.
That my brain finds ways of getting dopamine other ways.
Yeah. That's the other thing that I realized in reading the book. Mike really does, he appreciates the smaller things in life, things that a lot of us overlook over, you know, the course of our day.
You know, I don't want to have a wholesale ad for Cafe Artigiano. Seriously, that is his passion now. That's his favorite drink.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when I was in the one recovery house and the other one, I had to live on a $610 welfare check. And let me tell you, that's humbling, because I'm a guy, I've worked since I was 14, always had a paper route or a job, always been self-reliant, and prided myself in that. And I was in a position where I could not work, I couldn't access any funds, and I was on welfare. It was $550 a month to stay in these recovery houses. I had $60 a month to spend.
Yeah.
And you know, I could get a cup of coffee at McDonald's every 2 or 3 days. Well, for me to be able to go to a Cafe Artigiano and order a breve misto and to sit there and read the paper and just go, oh, my God, what a wondrous and beautiful day. It really is. It's true. I just, every morning I try to, sometimes it's tough and Maureen has to challenge me, but I wake up and I go, what a wonderful life this is, and what wonderful thing can I do today and experience today.
Well, what's a lesson for young people that hear you and read about your story? I mean, is there something here that's instructive for them and how they navigate life as they get older, perhaps?
Well, there's so many ways to look at that, Joe. The difficulty is that if you start drinking before the age of 16, the probability of becoming, you know, an alcoholic or an alcohol problem user is really, really high.
Mm.
And I have 3 sons, but if you can hang in there till 21 without drinking, you know, it's like 5% that you may become an alcoholic.
Mm.
So, you know, when they established the legal drinking age at 51, at 21, however many years ago, somebody knew something.
Yeah.
You know.
I think one of the things, though, Mike, that especially for young people, I feel, I think we all have to help families, especially families struggling with young people. And I don't mean by sending them to Al-Anon. Michael is heading off to Houston, actually, in June for some training on a new model that really supports families, especially families dealing with young and defiant addicts. I think that, you know, if you get cancer, the neighbors show up with a casserole.
Yeah.
You know, I think we have to have a lot more compassion for our friends and families who have an addict.
Yeah.
Yeah, with this CRAFT model, it's called the CRAFT model, Community Reinforcement and Family Training. What they do, if there's an individual in the family that's a problem user, you don't even, you know, try to send them to treatment if they're resistant, and you work with the family alone, all the concerned significant others, and after 4 or 5 sessions of that family training and therapy, 7 out of 10 of those resistant, defiant users will buy in, because the family has learned how to engage them in a way that isn't about confrontation and punishment and anger and shame.
And having gone through what you've gone through, Mike, now that you're in practice there in West Van, does that first-hand knowledge and that struggle, I mean, that must inform the work that you do now a great deal, doesn't it?
Well, Joe, I had a very successful practice in Penticton and thought I was doing a pretty good job and was told that I was doing a pretty good job. But I'll tell you, after what I've been through and experienced, what I've experienced, and when somebody sits in front of me and starts to talk about how awful it is for them and how they feel, I can really say now, I do know how you feel.
Yeah.
I do know how you feel. And there's this unbelievable kind of magical connection that happens when that person sees that. I don't even know what level it's at, but there's this connection that happens. And I think it's from that deep, genuine sense, that deep sense of empathy.
Yeah.
And thank God, you know, I have some credentials and some professional experience. You add the two together, and away we go.
Well, when we look at the news, and we've been consumed by the Rob Ford story for the last year or so, you know, it's easy to make fun of him because he's a politician. It's easy to make fun of him because of how he looks and what he says and the sort. But you know, and crack is, you know, easy to make fun of, I guess. But I know we shouldn't speculate on what's going on in his life, but it seems to me that alcohol is the biggest problem for him. Is that your sense?
I think it is, and you know, I feel really bad for Rob Ford, and you know what, and more than that, I feel really bad for Rob Ford's family and his children and his wife and his brother that is obviously in some kind of, you know, deep systemic denial. And there's a perfect example of where the family approach would really be helpful, I think, be really beneficial. You know, go and work with Rob Ford's family, work with his brother, his wife, his mother, and all the relatives that love him. You know, he's a man that has family that love him. And if you know, they could sit down with somebody that experienced and trained in the model that I'm referring to, we do, you know, 4, 5, 6 sessions with Rob Ford's family, I think that whole scene would change for Rob Ford.
Yeah.
You know, that would pull him in, because it's the lure of the power and the prestige of being the mayor, and that's a tough thing. You know, he's in an... The irony is he's probably addicted to that.
Yeah.
Because I think he is one of these characters, like a lot of us, that has this obsessive-compulsive nature. And in an odd kind of paradoxical way, I think all this tension is addictive too for him.
Maureen, when you look at the whole story, you look at Mike's life and in putting this together and helping him put this together and crafting it as you have. I mean, it's a really great job that you both did with this book.
Thank you.
How do you just come away from all of this, the process of writing and publishing a book as you have, in terms of just understanding Mike better? I mean, you have to live with a guy, mm-hmm. and so
you poor woman.
I mean, does it clarify any things after?
Yeah, you know, I think that there were initially some behaviors in Mike that I didn't understand, and as we wrote the book, I certainly came to understand them. Like he bought a pair of running shoes half price at $60. And he returned them 3 times. He couldn't get his head around the fact that he could actually buy himself new shoes.
Mm.
I see him asleep sometimes at night, and I look at him, and it's pounding rain. And I think, oh, he slept outside in the rain. I mean, there's elements of his life that I feel huge compassion for, and I know the further we move away from those things, I think, you know, oh, surely he's coming to deal with that, and it's, you know, receding in his mind. But no, there's almost like a cancer survivor. He's got a special excitement about life now, and I've come to really appreciate that about him.
Yeah. Well, this is such a wonderful book, and it's been such a pleasure talking to both of you today after having read it, because you guys just, you know, you're doing a lot of people, I think, a great service in terms of telling this story. And the work that you do outside of all of this. So congratulations on this book, and good luck with it, both of you.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Joe. It was my pleasure.
You're very welcome. MichaelPond.ca is the website for more. You can get the book there and elsewhere. I've seen it promoted at various shops throughout the city. You can get that there and online, of course. The book is called The Couch of Willingness, An Alcoholic Therapist Battles the Bottle and a Broken Recovery System. It's published by Everywhere Now Press. Maureen Palmer and Mike Pond join me on the line from North Vancouver. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plata.